Well, you look relatively normal.
Relatively? Yeah.
You don't look, you look like a...
There's no, there's an absence of fangs and, right. and stuff, yeah.
You have both hands?
I have both hands. Actually, I have a third, but I'm just not showing it.
you look well-adjusted, and, you know, I knew what you were going to look like because I had the photograph.
Right.
I had the photograph.
Right.
I have it somewhere.
Right.
So I wasn't surprised.
You weren't expecting a monster.
No, I wasn't. Before we start, tell me a little bit about the chronology of the books.
Okay.
First of all, the English chronology, and then we'll go to the American. I'm trying to get these squared away.
Yeah, okay. 1, 2, and 3 are the Books of Blood. The third volume comes out in October. Were done as volumes 1, 2, and 3 of Blood in England. Now, volumes 4...
Now, we're talking about the Berkeley paperbacks.
That's right. They were done as with exactly the same titling and exactly the same numbering in English editions.
Were they hardcover?
They were. They were actually a rather odd arrangement in the sense that they began as soft cover and were very successful. And I designed covers for them. They then did them in limited and trade hardback, which then sold out. It was the reverse of the normal procedure. I then did the novel Damnation Game, which Ace Hardcover are doing in the spring, which was, again, very successful, and I was asked to do 4, 5, and 6 of the Books of Blood, which were then picked up by Simon Schuster, in fact, by Poseidon. And Poseidon decided, because they had a slightly different marketing gambit, as is apparent from the two editions you've got in front of you. One was a sort of down market, dare I use that phrase, and one was a little bit more up market. In fact, that is Volume 4 of the Books of Blood.
The Inhuman Condition is Volume 4?
Yeah. And Volume 5 will be called In the Flesh, and Volume 6 will be called The Life of Death. And that was a device on behalf of Poseidon, I think a good one, to distinguish their editions, which are a slightly different catchment area, I think, in potential audience, even though, in fact, in England, they were published as 1 to 6 of the Books of Blood.
Well, you're certainly going to confuse your bibliographers.
It's going to be a pain in the behind for those people, yeah. In fact, it's made more confusing still because of the backtracking editions, the fact that there were hardback editions after there were paperback editions, which is, I don't know, is that common here? Doing softback and then doing hardback? Doing softback then hardback.
It happens very rarely. The early novels of Kurt Vonnegut were initially published in paperback.
Right.
And as he began to catch on as a cult figure, his books were then
published
in hardback.
That happened with Philip K. Dick too, didn't it?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think that's right. But it tends not to happen too much. The Inhuman Condition is getting a kind of coverage, which maybe if it had been Volume 4 of the Books of Blood, it wouldn't have got, because the hardback carries a certain authority which a paperback doesn't.
Now, I wonder why Poseidon didn't print hardcovers of the first two volumes.
Because Poseidon, you mean Berkeley didn't publish, yeah, that's Poseidon.
No, why didn't Poseidon publish hardcovers of the first two books?
Because they weren't ever offered them to buy. Berkeley came in very quickly, and they weren't sold by my agent. They were sold by Sphere, who owned the world rights to them, because they were the first books I ever published. And basically, I signed a sucker's contract, and they possessed them to sell everywhere this side of Mars. And they sold them to Berkeley because they had quite a tight relationship with Berkeley.
So the deal with Berkeley came before the deal with Poseidon?
Yeah, like 18 months before. And then for the second three books, because I had a little bit more power by that stage, my agent said, no, you get the English rights only, but we get to sell the American rights. And we went to a number of publishers basically asking what they would pay. And by that stage, Poseidon were talking quite large numbers. So we said, sure, why not?
So number 4, then, The Inhuman Condition.
Yeah.
Will be followed by hardcover editions of 5 and 6,
exactly.
Also by Poseidon.
Yeah.
Now, when we finish up with volume 3, in the Berkeley paperbacks, are they finished?
As far as Berkeley is concerned, yes. They are doing Berkeley's hardback, Ace Hardback, are doing the Damnation Game, which is the novel that I did between these two sets of three.
Ace next. Is affiliated with Berkeley.
Yeah, I don't know quite the relationship there, but there's I don't quite know how that works, but they're all in the same building. And so volume so the Damnation game will come out in Ace hardback, and then I suppose it'll come out in Berkeley paper at a later point. Simon Schuster and Poseidon have the Inhuman Condition, and then number two of their selection is going to be called In the Flesh, and number three is going to be called The Life of Death, and then they've just in two weeks' time I deliver another big fat novel to them. And I think that's it. I get confused.
What's that one called?
It's called Weave World. It's actually a fantasy book. It's not a horror book. It's a dark fantasy book with some monsters in it, with some serious
now,
monsters.
Have all of these books been printed in England?
No, Weave World hasn't been printed. The other seven have. Mm-hmm. Poseidon will publish Weave World. They will be the first to publish it because they commissioned it, so they will do it first.
Did you write these short stories
yeah.
as stories that were to be collected in volumes, or were you able to place them in magazines?
No, I never tried to place them in magazines. I'd never published anything before these books, and so I never published in a magazine or anything, and it never even occurred to me, to be perfectly honest. I just did. I saw a book edited by Kirby McCauley called Dark Forces, which is a big volume, which contains King and Bradbury and Joyce Carol Oates and Singer and Ramsey Campbell and a bunch of other really top class writers, some of whom are known as horror writers, many of whom aren't. I mean, Singer isn't known as a horror writer, and Joyce Carol Oates certainly isn't. And I think there's 22 stories there in toto, and they are as different as they could be. You know, some of them are comedy, some of them are quite sexy, some of them are sort of black and so on. And I thought, this is a nice idea, you know. Here is a volume which is about horror fiction. It's all horror fiction, but it covers such a range. Wouldn't it be really good to have a go at that? And to sort of see if, instead of it being 22 authors, it was just one. Just seeing how far I could push the horror genre in various directions, you know, into the light, frothy comic stuff, into the dark, heavy, gross-out stuff, into the subtle ghost stuff, and so on. And the consequence is, I think, 30, maybe 30 or 31 quite long short stories. I
mean, some of them are almost novellas.
I think that's right. And in those six volumes, therefore, in the three volumes of the Books of Blood and in the three volumes of the Poseidon doing, there is... There's a wonderful line that Woody Allen came up with when he did everything... you ever wanted to know about sex but were afraid to ask. He said, this movie contains the seven funniest things I could think of about sex, including several that led to my divorce. And my idea with this stuff was to write the scariest, all the scariest stuff I could find, you know, the stuff which I wanted to read, and just put them into one. It was too much to hope that they would be in one book. But maybe one day, there'll be a volume which will contain the complete short fiction. You know, horror fiction, which would be a lot of
words. That should be long after you've departed this veil.
passed over.
You know, the only book that Shakespeare ever wrote, the collected
that's
plays.
Right, that's right, that's right. It's a long work, though. It's a long work.
So it's better, it's, in terms of being a writer, better to have a separate volume.
Absolutely. Okay. It's just that the idea originally was, and remains, that that somebody enjoy the these pieces almost by contrast with each other, that, you know, you look at this stuff and you read through it and you see that horror fiction is not, as I did when I looked at Dark Forces, horror fiction is not limited to a number, you know, two or three tones. You can go in lots of different directions, and that's nice. It's always very nice when somebody comes up. I've just been to a signing and people come up and say, I've read all six books, and that's very nice.
Where did they get them? Are you talking about in England?
Black market? No, black market imports, I suspect.
Taiwan piracy.
That's right, absolutely. Yeah, with all the misspellings that implies, yeah.
Well, it's inevitable that in this country, since Stephen King is so dominant in the genre, that there is a comparison. But and I've read all of the stories in Inhuman Condition and a number of the stories in these other two volumes.
Yeah.
They kind of blur in my mind as to which volume has which stories.
Yes,
but I don't see any similarity because Stephen King has is almost a formula that he has. You approach these horror stories in a variety of different ways.
Right.
But he seems to write the same kind of story. Inevitably, the horror is built around an innocent person or family or persons who are then caught up in this episode in ways that they cannot cope.
Yeah.
Almost every one of his stories that I recall is exactly like that. But you have gone off in much different directions. So I don't really see, except that they're horror stories, I don't see much of a linkage there. But I'm sure that as your name catches on, people are going to say, hey, another Stephen King. But if they read carefully, I don't think they're going to find that your stories are much like his.
No, I think there's one thing we do have in common, where both of us do actually care about scaring people. And we do both care about the genre. I mean, I care about horror fiction as a form. And I know Stephen King does. I've never met him, but reading interviews and so on, it's very obvious that he's, you know, he does care about it. He does see it as a place in which he can put his best literary endeavors and his best human insights. And he doesn't at any point write down to the genre. There's never a trace of condescension in his attitude to the genre. And I think that's great, because I think there is a general perception that horror fiction is something of a literary underdog, that it's the last refuge of a literary scoundrel. And I don't feel that at all. I share with him the belief that horror fiction can be witty, elegiac, profound, sexy, funny, whatever else. And I think we have those two things in common. We both desire to scare people, and we both believe that scary material can be good material. You know, you don't have to be a hack.
Now, you're going to get this sort of criticism about any genre, westerns, romance,
right.
Books, science fiction particularly, mm-hmm. Comes under fire by especially academic critics.
Yeah.
And it's not fair. You mentioned Ray Bradbury a while ago. He was my link between science fiction and real literature.
Right.
And indeed, he doesn't even write science fiction.
But you see, now, even in the way that you phrased that, I think there was a problem.
Sorry about that. I shouldn't have phrased it like that. Yes,
but
that
there was. You know.
Well, I shouldn't. Let me rephrase that, because I didn't mean that the way it sounded. He was my link between science fiction and other forms of literature.
Great.
Because
fine.
When I was a
we
teenager
no
and was reading Ray Bradbury,
yes.
I was just obsessed by science fiction. And my mother used to say, "That's all you read. That's all you read."
Right.
And in a way, she was right. But he began to go out in other forms and other directions. He was poetic in his writing, and
uh-huh.
So he made me go off in other directions. So I didn't mean that the way it sounded.
No, I think that what was implicit in that structuring, you know, that he was the link between you and real literature, is actually quite a commonly held prejudice that somehow or other there is genre literature and there's real literature, and
I take that back the way I phrased it.
Yeah,
I don't.
Sure, that point's taken on your behalf, but I do think that there are an awful lot of people outside this room who would agree with your first phrasing, that that basically genre literature cannot ever be, by definition, cannot ever be real literature. This is plainly a nonsense, because since the beginning of novels, since the beginning of storytelling, there has been genre literature of various kinds. There has all the genre literature implies, it seems to me, is that there is a certain class of story which is associated with a certain milieu, which is associated maybe with a certain kind of narrative approach. Now, you may as well say that's true of the Decameron or Shakespeare or Dickens or Defoe or whatever else. I would say that within the mainstream, as it's known, there are quite clearly genres. There is quite clearly an adultery on campus genre. There are quite clearly areas of, you know, mainstream and heavy inverted commas novel writing which can be split up and can be said to have generic qualities. They have things in common, you know, like the Middle Age crisis novel. But nobody calls
which one is that? I would like to that.
There's quite a lot of them available. I don't think that there's any... I can see from the publisher's point of view, it's important that you market and your book in a certain way, and you find a way to promote it that's going to reach its potential readership. However, I think the danger of that, the downside of that, is that you separate the readers off, so that I think and hope that The Inhuman Condition has a sufficient literary quality and narrative merit to interest readers who would not ever think of picking up a horror book.
Well, I won't mention his name again, but except this last time, Stephen King. I think there's a difference in the quality of writing. I think that you write more carefully, in a more of a literary manner than Stephen King, who is obviously a genius, and he's bursting at the seams with ideas,
right,
and he has to get them down on paper, and so he knocks these stories out, and he himself has admitted that his work could stand revision. But he goes on to another one,
yeah,
and another one, and another one. So sometimes he has three books a year, mm-hmm, or more, mm-hmm, coming out, especially when he gets his old ones out of the drawer and,
yeah,
and reprints them.
Yeah.
Peter Straub is another writer who has perhaps not quite as well known as Peter King, but who is more like you in terms of his approach to writing, which is...
I'm a great admirer. I used to... It's a great point of pride with me. I just moved a month ago in a house 13 houses from where Peter wrote Ghost Story, in London. 13 being a significant number in this context. And I'm a great admirer of Peter's stuff. I'm a great admirer of Stephen's stuff too, simply because he's just, as you say, sort of bursting with ideas, and the stuff is written with such energy. The other thing that, of course, he's done is he's legitimized to a great extent the genre. He's brought the genre out of the cold. And, you can't go to an airport or a railway station without finding somebody somewhere reading a Stephen King book.
Well, of course, there's an ancient tradition of horror, and it goes, yeah, back many years. And in fact, the early movies are staples on Saturday night. It's Frankenstein,
yeah,
and Wolfman in London, or is that what it's called? I'm not sure. Dracula, and, yeah, all of these are not only available as film, but they're available to read.
Yes.
So it's a genre that has appealed to people for years.
But I think it plugs in to so many basic anxieties, so many basic fears, and those fears are more or less constants. The format may change. We may look at, I certainly look at Lon Chaney, or more particularly Bela Lugosi, and find it a bit hokey because the acting style has changed and so on. But the dark and losing your life to something that sucks at your neck in the night, that's not going to change as a source of fear. I can't help thinking that in 200 years' time, 300 years' time, whatever, we are still going to be waking in the night worrying about those basic problems.
Are you religious at all?
Not at all, no.
I wondered about that because there seems to me in horror literature underlying religious premise that there is a life after life. And so I just wondered about horror writers and how they feel in terms of mysticism, because either they completely reject it and just write off the wall, or deep within they feel that, well, there is a hereafter, and the hereafter can represent itself in various macabre ways.
I don't call myself religious in the sense that I have no organized religion. I don't go to churches, synagogues, or temples. But I do think that our lives are charged up with all kinds of subtext, all kinds of atmospheres, all kinds of sensibilities which are not available to rational analysis. And if that is a description, as I think it probably is, of a nascent religious urge, then I confess to being religious. I wouldn't call it religious, because religious implies religion, and I don't have a religion. What I have is a sense that the world is strange and elaborate and difficult to comprehend if you simply use your reason. But if you apply principles which may be called poetic, if you apply your subconscious and your imagination to the world, I think it makes more sense than if you try and beat it to death with your reason alone. And I think that is probably the beginning of a religious impulse. I have no urge to worship. I have no urge to believe in a deity that organizes anybody's life. I cannot make that work in my head. I can't make that work. What I can believe is that there is system, that there are ways that the world works, that life works, that we are gradually getting hold of. And some of those ways are not ways which a scientist could ever get hold of. It requires a poet to get hold of them, or even a storyteller. Because I think storytellers are making patterns all the time, and those patterns either seem true or they don't seem true.
And don't forget, there are some very bad poets around.
There are some very bad, there's also some very bad scientists.
That's true. Parenthetically, Peter Straub had cut it both ways, referring to what we were talking about with an underlying mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
In Floating Dragon, where there was a cloud of
gas.
Gas of yeah. some kind, from the laboratory, and the reader was never quite certain whether the horror actually was occurring or whether the gas distorted the perceptions of the people.
Sure. I think there's actually a very noble tradition of such ambiguities, and there was also long been a tradition of, particularly in the movies, of mysteries that seem to be supernatural and within the last 5 minutes get revealed as absolutely unsupernatural, you know, that somebody is trying to drive somebody mad or somebody needs hold of the will or whatever else. And there are means by which narratives get set up as apparently supernatural and get revealed otherwise. I never really bothered with that structure because it seems to me that somebody's going to pick up a horror book in the first place. They're willing to suspend their imaginations. Certainly, suspend their disbelief, I'm sorry, and enter the imagination. Certainly, my enthusiasm is to make that as credible as possible. And I will go to great pains to make the reality of the thing very concrete and tangible. But I don't see... I've never really contemplated the notion of sort of hedging my bets. If somebody picks up one of my books, they're in for an imaginative roller coaster ride. And I'm not going to get them off at the end of it and say, well, actually, guys, you know, that was all in their minds.
Now, there's something else kind of interesting to me as I was reading The Inhuman Condition. For the most part, you haven't given away the location. Now, there's one story you've set on the subway train in New York. There's another one that was interesting. It was set in a motel,
in Texas.
These stories could be set anywhere.
Yeah.
Now, there was one story in one of the books, can't remember the title, but that was the one where they were doing experiments in the laboratory, sexual experiments.
Yeah, the Age of Desire.
Yeah, Age of Desire.
Yeah.
And you could tell that was in England simply because when the killer was sought by the two police officers and he attacked one of the police officers in the boarding house.
Yeah.
They didn't have weapons with them.
Yes.
Now, anybody goes to make an arrest in this country carries a weapon.
End of story. Yes. In fact, later on, he goes to Soho as well, which is clearly recognizable as, you know...
It was funny because the cops said to the landlady who complained about being attacked,
said,
find me a weapon.
Yeah, right.
Find me a policeman. Find me a weapon.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. That's part of the thing there is, I mean, there are stories which are clearly set in South America or in Texas or in New York, or there are some which are clearly set in London. There's even a couple which are set in my native Liverpool. But there's a couple in the Aegean and one in Yugoslavia. We spread it over. My concern really is that there are very, very fine and able writers. Ramsay Campbell, for instance, who is a fellow Liverpudlian, who's basically cornered Liverpool as a source of anxiety. I mean, there's very little that you can do in terms of recreating Liverpool as a source of weird events and weird perceptions that Ramsay hasn't already done. And, of course, Stephen King has founded Castle Rock as a place where a good deal of his material takes place.
And most of it takes place in Maine, and it amuses me that when a motion picture is filmed of his work, it's set in California.
Yeah, yeah, well,
it doesn't match.
That's the vagaries of Hollywood at work, I think. But I've endeavored to sort of spread the locations, in part because I think that it just adds a little bit of local color once in a while to be able to do that. And also because I genuinely do like sort of trying to recreate in my own mind what it might be like in Texas where I have never been, or the jungles of South America. And in part because these are constants. These are stories which, in principle, if they're going to scare you, they're going to scare you wherever they happen. And so it's just fun to be able to do that. I don't think I could ever give myself over to a single environment and just stay there. I have a low boredom threshold for that kind of thing. I want to get out and about, you know.
Liverpool,
yeah.
As you were growing up, conventional childhood?
Very conventional. Conventional in the best sense. I mean, not conventional in the banal sense, but just, yeah, a good, stable, you know, one brother, mother and father at home, and sweetly loving. And still
literary family?
Not at all, no. I have a great, great Irish grandfather who's a poet, or was a poet. That's about it. I never read any of his poetry. I don't think it's still around. My father is part Irish, my mother is part Italian. And a very, very conventional childhood. But I always was interested in the imaginative, in the outlandish. It always seemed so much more interesting than the life I was living. It still does. Mm-hmm. It still does.
Where did you go to school?
I went to school in John Lennon's school in Liverpool. I followed John Lennon's footsteps, as it were.
Talking about the lower grades.
That's right. And then I went on to art college. I was going to go on to art college, and again would have followed in his footsteps, but my parents decided I should do something useful that would give me a job, so I studied philosophy.
Where did you study?
Again, in Liverpool. I mean, I didn't want to go to university at all. I had no desire to do it. I wanted to go to art college, and I got into the Royal College of Art, and then they said, no, please do this for us. Will you study something that, you know, a profession which you will be useful in your later life? And I said, well, I'm really only interested in English literature and philosophy. So they said, do English literature and philosophy, but just get a degree, which I did. And, you know, they were happy with the piece of paper. I've never used it, but, it made them happy. And then I went on my own sweet way and went down to London writing plays and doing illustration.
That's right. I was reading in some of the biographical material that you have been a playwright.
Yeah.
So you left college, you went to London and began writing. How did you sustain yourself during that? Or did you have a couple of big hits?
Never. With great difficulty. I mean, I managed to sort of hobble from play to play more than run. It was a very tough time, and it lasted a long time because I wasn't actually published until I was just about touching 30, and up until that time I'd been doing plays on the fringe, which is the sort of equivalent of off Broadway, and as anybody who works off Broadway knows, that does not make you serious money. In fact, it doesn't make you money, full stop. And so I was doing some illustration work. And I was writing plays and having a thoroughly good time, but not making very much money. And that was fine, because in fact, my grounding in theatre, I think, has been very important. I think it's very affected very strongly the kind of literature that I write and the way that I write it.
Outside of your plays,
yeah,
and the horror stories, have you written anything in any other style?
Well, Weave World is very much.
That's the fantasy.
It's a dark piece, but it does take my work in a different direction, and the plays varied right across the board. Some of them were comedies. I have a play opening in London when I get back called The Secret Life of Cartoons, which is about as far from the inhuman conditions as it's possible to get, and that's a comedy and quite a tender, romantic comedy with cartoons, and I've written a couple of Grandguignol plays. I did a play called Frankenstein in Love, which sort of speaks for itself, a romance, and I did a piece called The History of the Devil, which again speaks for itself, and a bunch of other stuff which is really quite light. So I suppose I've done stuff in a number of tones, but what they have in common is a desire to entertain very strongly. And I think that one of the things about writing for the theatre is that you are made very aware of how very low most people's boredom threshold is.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I did want to ask you, the source for some of the plots that you develop for your stories? Do you have nightmares in the middle of the night and suddenly wake up and jot them down?
I have dreams which can sometimes offer me scenes, but no, I don't have nightmares. I don't have bad dreams. I don't have bad times. My subconscious is alive and well and living between the pages of my books.
Well, how did you come up with an idea of an army of hands chasing after a...
Well, that's an extension from a... You know, I think one of the things I do is try and take ideas to the limits. You know, whenever I get an idea, I push it as hard as I possibly can to the point where I say, can I get away with any more? And there have been the precedents for that, you know, the Beast of Five Fingers and the Hands of Orlac, you know, hands that weren't quite in their owner's control, or indeed liberated and running all over Peter Lorre's face. So, I mean, there have been examples, but they tend to have been lone hands. I thought it would just be rather fun to push that idea as far as I possibly could until maybe I ended up with 200 hands or whatever. I do that often, I think, in the fiction. I actually take an idea and just see how far I can push it. And that's an article of faith with me to the limit, you know.
Well, the readers of the Books of Blood and the Inhuman Condition should probably read in the morning so that they can sleep. Certainly an engaging young man, Clive Barker, and it was fun reading the books, and I know that Americans are going to enjoy them. So
thank you
very much for stopping in.
Thank you.